FM tape interviewer Paul Cecil, 10 October 1980, Tarpon Springs, Florida. This is tape number 80-1 interview. Just to run down through the line. Go ahead and give your name and when you were in Vietnam. And
okay, my name is Charlie Hubbs. I was in Vietnam from June of 1966 to May of 1967. I flew 411 missions, and my primary duty was attachment commander of the Ranch Hand Group at Da Nang Air Force Base, although I flew both from Saigon and Ben Hoa.
Okay, basically what we want to do is, you know, your impressions of Vietnam, of the ranch operation.
Well, when I arrived there, there were 6 aircraft. And of course, I had very little knowledge of the ranch itself. Although the mission wasn't classified, there just weren't very many returnees from the ranch. So therefore, information on the ranch itself and its activities and the type of people in it was extremely limited to the folks back here going through the training.
What kind of training did you have before going to Vietnam?
Well, I was primarily a single-engine jet pilot, but when I was assigned, I volunteered for NAM, and I volunteered for single-engine fighters. I didn't get it. I was pretty discouraged, and I got the 123, but I was still going to go to NAM. When I got to Hurlburt, it was obvious that the air commandos had quite a bit of esprit corps, and it wasn't going to be quite as bad as I thought it. And one thing I did determine immediately was I did not want to be a trash hauler. That there was another group, and this is where I first heard about the ranch, that seemed to have a little more esprit de corps, and that always has always intrigued me, and I think it always does to single engine pilots who've got a mind of their own of sorts. And I'm not disparaging multi-engine pilots, but I'm talking that when there is an assignment, you see as we find a single engine guy, I'll go try to find where the action is. But anyway, there was just enough information at Hurlburt to lead me to believe I wanted to get into the ranch. And so I asked to be assigned over to a ranch assignment. That took some doing, and it took a lot of drink buying and a lot of hard-nosed politicking, but I finally got the damn thing. The training we got at Hurlburt was standard trash hauler training, and the use of the various words here doesn't bother you, does it?
But no, that's fine. Yeah,
you'll work them out, okay. But that was all right. I had a just returned instructor who managed to do all kinds of strange things to get me ready for combat, and he looked to me like a true commando, and a big mustache and a big knife and tough as nails, except for one thing. He did the most beautiful watercoloring paintings in the world, which is a total dichotomy. It blew my mind when I found out who he was. He's probably one of the top 10 in the country. And but anyway, he got me mentally psyched up to go to war.
Who was
that? This was Doc Weaver.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Doc lived in Patrick. His family was in Patrick, but because of the shortage of instructors, they had put him back to Hurlburt for 120 days TDY, but one of the stipulations was that he would have an aircraft at his disposal each weekend to go home. So that meant, since I had come from Patrick also, that we went home every weekend. So my training for Vietnam was rather interesting. I wasn't overly worked too hard. I enjoyed the flying, and I was home with my family every weekend.
Did you do any practice spraying at Hurlburt?
No, none at all.
None at all.
No. Then we went to Langley for what was supposed to be a 30-day training course, and it lasted a little over 2 weeks. The weather was good, everything went fine, no problem. And we did a lot of flat level hauling around of light airplanes, which of course was totally incongruous. When we got over to Vietnam, we found out we were flying 10,000 pounds overweight, and we were flying the mountains, and none of the above had I any training for. But that was minor, because you learn fast, somebody will teach you.
When you say you were flying overweight, they were actually, your takeoffs were above the tech order allowable
above
gross weight.
Tech order allowable gross weight.
As a regular thing.
That was standard procedure. Yeah. And I got to Clark Air Force Base, and by now they really had me convinced I was an air commando. They'd gotten to me, between Doc and the rest of those folks, and some parachute jumps that I made. You want a side light?
That's fine. Anything you got?
One of the. One of the things that I liked about Doc was that his idea about regulations, since he's recently returned from Vietnam, they were rather lackadaisical, to say the least. And because I'd gone through parachute training back in the past sometime, of course I was parachute rated, and I had quite a number of jumps. I forget how many I had, 40 or 50 at the time. There were a bunch of Green Berets that wanted to go have us drop them en route to a practice trash hauler flight one day while we were at Hurlburt. So Doc and I got our heads together and went down the night before, and we put a main and a spare parachute in the cabin of the aircraft. And the next morning when the Green Berets came down to make their jump, I briefed them as if I was the aircraft commander. And I briefed them specifically that they were not to jump until they got the signal from the aircraft commander. Under no condition were they to jump out of the airplane. And we got in the airplane, cranked up. As soon as we got airborne, I wiggled into my parachutes. And then I flew the aircraft to the DZ. Of course, I was unstrapped. I was just sitting in the seat. And I had the loadmaster drop the ramp. And as I saw the DZ coming up on the nose, I ran out of the cockpit and ran out the ramp of the aircraft and bailed out. And I landed right on the DZ. But because of the ultimate confusion that came about in the airplane, I watched the Green Berets scatter themselves through half of Florida's pine trees while Doc made a short field landing, picked me up on the ramp, and we took off, and we never ever wanted to meet any Green Berets from that exercise again.
Outstanding.
So, I got to point out that we had another, we always flew with three pilots, as you know, in training, so there was a co-pilot, a modified co-pilot on board after I jumped out. So that stirred a little interest too. There's things like that. It kind of gave me the idea that these air commandos were something to hang around with. By the time I got to Clark Air Force Base, I was totally commandoized. Back in Hurlburt, some young folks had taken a 51 Ford that I had brought to the base and given it about a $5,000 paint job. It looked just like an A-1 fighter plane. It had the everything an A-1 fighter plane would have had on as far as the camouflage goes. And when they delivered that to me the next morning after having borrowed it, what I thought was a night on town, and it came back all painted, I thought, well, I've got to go to town. So I got in the car, and downtown I went, right through the gate, and the guard just didn't seem to pay any attention to me. So when I had a few thousand drinks and decided to come back, I thought, now this is going to get a little dicey. You see, they painted over all the windows. It was just slits, like a tank would have. Just little black tubbing, little slits, and the windows were all painted over black. So I started back in through the gate. I noticed that the guard looked off into space, and he never saw me. And for the next 2 months, nobody ever acknowledged that the car ever came on or off the base. And at one of our favorite gin mills down there, Bacon's, I was allowed to park on the grass because the car couldn't be seen and nobody would worry about it. Bacon actually wanted to buy the car from me when I left. Well, I didn't sell it to him. But during that 2 months, one night, the door fell off. I meant to tell you that there was a big rusty spot in the floor and you could see the ground through the driver's side. But one night, the door fell off in an intersection, so we welded it back on at an all-night gas station. And from then on, I entered the car by climbing in and out the window. And another time, at about 70 miles an hour, the roof, which had gotten quite rusty, it was a hardtop, pulled it back over the trunk. So we pulled that back down and wired it down to the windscreen with coat hangers. Well, I just turned the car over to somebody in the next class, and the next I heard of the car was a letter that said they were having a beer on Sunday morning at the BOQ at Hurlburt when the state police car drives up, the state policeman gets out, takes the left front fender from the camouflage car, drops it next to it in the parking lot, gets back in the state police car and drives away. The story behind it was that somebody came out of the beach club, made a left, got on the median strip, and was doing fine because it was camouflaged, obviously, so nobody knew the car was in the median strip, right? But he hit the welcome to Fort Walton Beach sign and knocked the left front fender off. We attributed all that to bad ice, of course. Anyway, I got to Clark, and as you can tell, by now, all this training is getting to be kind of a bore, and Doc had told me to avoid anything that had anything less to do than fighting the war. So I went over to the counter where the survival school people check in, and I asked for myself, and they said I hadn't arrived. I asked them when would they expect me. They said they didn't know. I said, well, is there any way you can check? And I got one of those curt answers that sergeants hardly ever give to officers. It's like something about, there isn't a goddamn piece of paper on this island that I can tell you who's been here, who's going to be here, or who's going to leave here. With that, I went over and booked myself into Saigon.
Never did go through survival.
Never went through survival school. I spent about an hour and a half at Clark. And nobody ever asked me about that either. It's in my record somewhere, though. I think it goes in automatically to go to Vietnam. When I got to Vietnam, I got off the aircraft at 1:30 and assumed that I was in Consanut, which is where the airplane was heading, what I'd signed on for, passenger manifest. And it was Benoit. And that left me in a bit of a quandary, so I went over and I got a telephone and I asked for an operator. And then I began to get my education on the telephone system in Vietnam. So I found out that you can't make very long phone calls. Well, rather than go into all the ways I found to make a phone call in Vietnam, like declaring emergencies and war alerts and things like that, and talking in a higher and more frightened voice than the other person that was trying to get the same line or more officially, you could overcome the operators and finally get one. And I asked for the motor pool in Tonsonut. And that gave that sergeant the best laugh I bet he probably had in about 20 years. Because he told me that two things were going to happen. One, staff cars weren't sent from Tonsonut to Benoit without an armored convoy to pick up non-persons such as myself arriving. And besides that, all the staff cars in Vietnam were tied up for them, the wheels. So I went back to my devices and said I thought I'd go over to the club. Of course, it wasn't air conditioned, and that was a bit of a disappointment. I decided I'd go to bed. I found out there was a transient quarters that had been built by the French Foreign Legion, I suspect about 1918, because inside I discovered a bunk that my father had carved his initials in World War I. And they were nice bunks. You just sat in them and you went down, you hit the floor, your butt would bounce, you knew you'd reached the bottom. And it was just raffle for the bunks. First guy in got a bunk. Mosquitoes were just unreal. So I went down to the only light I could find, which was a latrine, and I started to write a letter home, and I never finished the letter because the mosquitoes swelled my eyes up. So I never got to even finish my first letter. Stayed up all night, found out there was a helicopter to Consanut at very early in the morning, crack of dawn, and I was on it. Landed, went into base ops, got a phone, asked for the ranch, that all worked fine. Ralph Dresser said, stay where you are, I'll be there in a minute. Picked me up in a Jeep, had me throw my bags down, put me on the strap in a C-123, and I flew two missions that morning. He gave me some guy's bunk that was off in Da Nang, I believe, at the time. And in 3 days, I'd flown seven missions, had a DFC, an air medal, and a wounded co-pilot. And I said, welcome to the war.
Ralph was the commander of the ranch detachment.
Yeah, he was a guerrilla. Okay. There's no question he was a guerrilla because he looked like a gorilla.
At that time, ranch was a detachment of the 309th. It wasn't a separate.
Yeah, we were a detachment of one of the squadrons. I forget all the numbers. I guess 309th was right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There were, of course, your first impressions are that these folks were totally crazy. They flew twice a day. And they didn't seem to take any time off. And they drank rather heavily. Because it was fly the airplane, get drunk, get some sleep, and then fly the airplane, get drunk, and get some sleep. Now, I didn't have time to get any of this in perspective because they had me flying two a day. I still hadn't, I didn't unpack my bags. I was just working out of an open bag. Still flying in my khakis, didn't even have a flight suit or any of the new fatigues or any of those things that I should have had over there. We were up about the third day. I think it was the third day. And I had never been shot at before by anybody. It was really hostile. And we're on a mission, and a shot came into the cockpit, and there was no question in my mind that a round had come into the cockpit. Even though I'd never been shot before, I knew we had a problem, because it was just like the books say. It sounded just like somebody hitting the side of meat with a slab. Now, I was in tight formation. I was in the left seat. I think I was number two. That meant I had a man on my right. I was in a van on the other side. I was sandwiched. And I knew that Ralph was supposed to be running the throttles, but I also knew he'd just been shot. Now, I decided the best course of action I could take would be to continue to look at the aircraft that I was flying formation on, and maybe everything would go away and nothing had happened. But the throttles continued to move. I would say every once in a while on the intercom, "Are you all right?" And I wasn't getting an answer. That was worrying me. And I didn't dare look at him because I knew it'd throw up. His head was shot off, and I just had it in my head that his head was gone. But the throttles kept moving, and we flew along. Finally, bleed after back and forth and back and forth half a dozen more times while I'm sweating profusely over there, not knowing what's going on with my co-pilot. Like, we climb up, and as I could break out and get some room, I looked over, and Ralph had out the biggest goddamn bowie knife I've ever seen in my life. And of course, he's a big guy anyway. He always carried oversized everything. He either had an oversized motorcycle or an oversized knife and an oversized gun, and he was picking shrapnel out of his arm, and his cigar was going a mile a minute. It didn't perturb him a bit. We went back, flew the next mission, and then he went over and got himself a Purple Heart.
Now, at this time, did you have the flak helmets and the flak vests, or was this before?
We had vests, but we didn't have the turtle collars or anything like that. We just had straight vests. We were sitting on one and wearing one.
Were these regular flak vests or the ceramic vests?
No, these were cheap ones. Oh. They were the first day stuff. We didn't get the ceramic stuff until about 3 or 4 months after I was there, and the week I was leaving, we got the turtlenecks. That's when Tom Davey got shot in the throat. If he'd had it on, he'd have made it. Tom?
It saved Jeffrey's heart. He got shot in the throat.
Yeah, well, Tom and I went over together, and I left a week before him, and Tom could have had one. They offered me one, and we both turned them down because, you know, those things stink so bad of your own sweat. You want to give it to a guy that's going to keep it for the whole year. So Tom didn't take one, I didn't take one, and of course he took the 30 right in the neck with Rags Raglan. And Rags had to hold his throat all the way over to the field, but he died before he could do anything for him. I found that the ranch had a uniqueness among the other people. Fighter pilots loved us. They just thought we were the greatest people in the world. We were the bait. We were the trolls.
Post office people, you go to the post office with your car fund, you can finance anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But the one thing that the fighter pilots wanted was a target. They were tired of just making toothpicks and killing monkeys, and if they went out with a ranch, they knew they had a good target. They knew that there was ground fire down there. That meant there was bad guys down there. They meant they were doing something pretty good. On several occasions I'd flown, I was qualified 100 at the time, but I couldn't fly combat because I wasn't combat qualified. So I had quite a few missions in the 100 as well as my ranch mission. And to go over 30,000 feet on a sky spot and drop six iron bombs from 30 grand is about as thrilling as nothing for a fighter pilot. So what they wanted was, they wanted a target. Well, of course, they called us the trollers and the bait and everything else. And to get a ranch mission was probably the biggest thing that happened to them. They just wanted to get down there because they knew they were firing into somebody that was shooting back. That was a good deal. I never ever heard a fighter pilot ever have a nasty word for a ranch hand. I've had more drinks bought for me by fighter pilots than I bought for them, although I always felt I owed them the rounds. They had a lot of respect for us.
Well, while you're on the subject, what's your opinion of the fighter pilots or the fighter support, really?
Well, that's
the ranch
what I was
got.
Going into, is the tactics were very difficult because we had A-1s just as I got there, which were a fantastic airplane for the cover. But the Vietnamese wouldn't go down. You don't know what they are. You know what they are? Yeah, the Vietnamese were smarter than we were. They had about 4,000 combat missions, and they were a little dicey about going down through overcast. Remember, they didn't have a navigator on board as we did, and I don't know whether their birds had all the exotic equipment that we had, but we were pretty safe in letting down into known valleys off of DMEs and a few other things. But they didn't like to go down through the overcast unless they were leading the reserve ball game. Of course, if they were following us, they didn't have that much confidence in our people letting down through the clouds. So if they got down on their own, they'd be there. If they didn't like it, they wouldn't be there, and we'd scrub the mission. We lost those immediately after I got there. They went to air search, or SAR. And then we picked up the B-57. Now that was another jewel. I saw a B-57, we were doing crop somewhere up north, immaterial where. And we were strung out pretty long because we were doing some really narrow valleys. And Lee called back and says, "Hey, an old man in the field just took a shot at me." And number two turned the corner and he says, "Hey, he's out there working on his rifle, seems to be jammed." And as I turned the corner, this voice came from out of the blue and it said, "Cowboy 3, move it out. Can't you see we're coming down?" And you could see through the top of the 123. And I looked up and here's this B-57 rolled over, coming down on a bomb run, bomb bay doors open. They put 16 500 pounders into that field where that man with the stuck rifle was. And that probably was a pretty fair account about what it cost to hit a take a target out over there.
Well, those iron bombs are probably coming.
But anyway, the
big hole.
We tried the F-5 next, and the F-5 was probably the least effective bird we ever used for support over there. It only had 20 mic, and it went so bloody fast, and it didn't have enough rounds in it to stay with us. It didn't have legs. We were very unhappy with that. After the F-5, they decided not to give us fighter cover for a while. So Ralph got a hold of a colonel up in 7, and he came down, but he had another colonel with him. So we're going to fly him on a mission without any fighter support. And Ralph comes back to me and he says, "Now listen," he said, "this other gray-haired colonel's going to fly with you." He said, "Now, he hasn't been flying in a long time and he's got a coronary condition. So I want you to take it real easy on him and don't you give him any trouble and don't you get anybody hurt." And about that time I said, "Oh boy, thanks for that good deal." So we went out on a mission and sure enough, it turned out to be one of those. Ralph knew where he was going. He picked the hottest damn target in South Vietnam. He was going to prove a point. And sure enough, the 50s started and the tracers started going and they're all shooting at Ralph. And I'm about to have a heart attack and I can't believe this guy sitting on the strap isn't having one. He was in better shape than I was when we got back. He took it a lot cooler than I did. I thought we were going to get blown right out of the sky. Next day, we had fighters back. Not only fighters, we got F-100s. And after we got drunk with them a few times and hashed it out, did a little talking, we got some tactics that worked. They went to the butterfly, and then we always had a bird in front of us, and they worked on the free ship formation. The F-4s I didn't feel were as effective as the F-100, but that was a personal opinion. I didn't like the F-4 myself as a pilot, so.
I like the F-4.
But I thought the 100 did a better job than the F-4, yeah.
And if it's approved, presented.
We went through a siege. We've got a new general over there. I believe it was Momeyer that came in and took away the baseball hats and the gun belts and all the things.
Yeah.
Of course, getting outfitted over there was a trick too. You know, you have to get your new fatigues all illegally cut, extra pockets for cigarettes and all kinds of nasty pouches and the Jane Fonda obscene recommendations for what she could do. And then you got your go to hell hat and you did all these wonderful things and you got your purple band and then you felt like you could pretty much go in any bar and anybody know who you were. And that was good because you didn't want to get hit. And nobody ever hit a ranch hand when I was over there. I thought that was a good move. But anyway, we were up at the Dang and it was just after General Momeyer had said there'll be no more baseball hats, no more scarves. And Skip Stanfield was the wing. Skip Stanfield was the wing commander. Nice guy, but he didn't have any use for the ranch. He didn't give us much support. This is initially. This changed later after he had a traumatic experience with us.
You're talking about 315th Wing Commander?
366th, I think it was.
Oh, okay. You're the fighter wing commander.
Yeah, fighter wing
366,
commander.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were using his base.
Okay.
So he was the host. And he had one staff meeting that he invited me to. It's the first one I was ever invited to. I went in, I had my purple scarf on, and he said, "Major, take off that goddamn scarf." And I said, "No, sir, I'm a ranch hand." Now, that may sound a little trite, but you know, that's exactly the attitude of the whole outfit. I didn't say it smart ass or anything like that. I just said it as I felt it. And it sounds collegiate or something, but it wasn't. It really wasn't in that particular time frame. So he said, I want you to take off that scarf or I'm going to call Saigon. I said, well, sir, I guess you're going to have to call Saigon because I'm not taking the scarf off. So he called Saigon in front of the staff. And that was the first mistake he ever made, I think. And he called down and he talked to somebody down there. And there was quite a bit of discussion. And he hung up the phone and he looked a little nonplussed. He said, well, they're going to call me back. Well, it didn't take long, maybe 20 minutes. And he called back and he says, Major, you're dismissed from this. You're dismissed from the staff meeting. You don't have to be here anymore. And he slammed down the phone. I knew I had the situation under control. I knew I was going to wear the scarf. But I didn't find the story out until approximately 2 months later when they told us that General Key had gotten wind of the scarves, and these scarves were all presented by Key to the original franchise. And as a result, General Key got wind of it, and he shut the gates at the Considine and said, you take the scarves off the cowboys, and the gates stay shut. And Mo Meyer said, let the cowboys keep their scarves. And that's supposed to be the way it happened. I know where the phone calls originated, and I know the bottom line was we kept our scarves at the name. So.
Well, I think that the thing was that, what's his name, John Cal Key or whatever it was, presented that scarf to Ralph. That was their, his own private squadron's
right.
Colors.
Yeah. It was just two Air Forces colors. Yeah, that's the...
Yuen Gao Ki.
Yeah. Nice fellow.
We had a beautiful place up there, wasn't it? Panrang?
Yeah.
His mansion?
That's true. Well, it never flew for me until the end of... Until the spring of 1967 was lead pilot qualified or he wasn't in the ranch. There was no such thing as a co-pilot. There weren't flights either, or anything like that. We never had a stand eval. Nobody would dare come check us out.
But
well, stand eval didn't have a. We had our own little stand eval there. But
you did, not me. Not when I was there.
But you
started
in a small outfit. You were a little tiny special detachment.
That's right.
Not a full big squadron.
It started when they went to squadron status. Remember, we only had six airplanes.
How many crews did you have?
We had one extra crew.
Okay, so you had seven crews. You're talking about 14 people, right?
We
16
had,
people with the ops officer command.
Did your own thing.
When I was in ICR, you know, we had a few real co-pilots, of which were, most of them were pretty talented. We had some guys really, as the year wound down, were lead qualified on a piece of paper. There's no way in hell they're going to leave them.
Never had the problem. Never had the problem. And we didn't have
numbers gets to be.
Yeah, well, I say, remember, you're talking a very small unit. It was so small, we were in everybody's pocket. There was no nothing.
Like one of the guys who comes here every year, you know, he's really a nice guy. I respect him and everything else, but as an aviator and a contributor, he went with a ship. I thought of
it. Yeah. Well,
these are just a flying crisis.
Like I say, it changed. Now you got to put everything's in perspective. You're talking the original ranch now.
Yeah, we talk about the old ranch and the new ranch and the guys that were there with Farm Gate ranch is a bunch of
they were
weenies.
Yeah, yeah, they're all new heads.
I think one of the
things
where my year had a real benefit, all these procedural things were really worked out and refined. You know, occasionally some little thing comes up, maybe you have to improve it. Predecessorily, you know, everybody had done their homework, made their mistakes, and had made some improvements in the tactics and the way we basically went about things. We had inherited, you know,
all standardized,
like fathers and kids. You know.
Sure.
Yeah, you got by word of mouth by what had worked and not worked for the guys before, not by a training manual.
And you know, of course, one of the basic things was don't spray uphill.
Yeah,
and
you find that out in a hurry.
Well, you know, I'm an old guy over there by that time, and I go up to Penang, start on the attachment. One of the guys, you know, fight for general, which he later did, Larson. He's not even a senior pilot. He's in charge of that thing, and he's leading this goddamn thing. And we're up there by the rock pile someplace, spraying uphill. And that's not bad enough, but not only is the ground shooting at us, but the goddamn artillery's going over us. And we have to peel down that damn canyon and come out of there, you know, dumping, and oh, what a mess.
Yeah.
And, you know, violated all the all the things we should know. You know, if we got our ass really kicked around that day, well, luckily we didn't lose it. But we violated all the rules. And if that was day one, you shouldn't have done that. You know?
Well, let me go back to the early part where we're still learning.
That's too young for me, Keith. Here you go, brother.
Oral history interview tape 80-1, side 2.
We found pretty quick in the business that we'd crack a target. Of course, remember, this time we were still establishing targets. Half the country hadn't even been looked at yet. So we were doing a lot of survey work and plotting our tactics. And we learned a lot through that. And again, as Hal said, Jim said, we've gone through an osmosis type learning process where you make a mistake once, you don't make it twice. But we found that the fragging was rather interesting, because if we fragged the target, it seemed like that's where the VC were. So we immediately came to the conclusion that our system wasn't too secure. So at Da Nang, it became a habit to tell Saigon anything they wanted to hear. We did our own fragging, by the way. See, this later changed, of course, this wasn't allowed. But up there we did our own fragging. And it depended on the party the night before. Did we want to go to a hot place or a cool place and things like that? We had some real decisions to make. And if we had a lot of hangovers, we'd probably go to a cool target. And things, I hate to say this, but it's true. We actually did do some fragging based on our physical shape the next day. But we always fragged three targets. And we told Saigon two of them. And as soon as we started doing that, our hit count went down tremendously.
I don't want to make you commit yourself. Are you implying that the Vietnamese headquarters let the VC know where you're going?
Well, I don't know whether it was done intentionally. It could just have been on the lines. Who knows? I don't know how it was being done. But if you did it by the book, you'd get shot up pretty badly. If you just fluffed around and gave them two or three targets and then went to the third one, you never took a head on the third one when you never told them down there.
And by the time I'm there, hell, you can't dictate your own target at all. I remember one day.
Oh, no. Well,
there's this big pile of rice, you know, they just stack it up like we do wheat in the United States, you know. And the Army reported they had something up, so, it seems like smart. We'll go over and, rather than chase it all over the countryside, just spray this pile of rice, you know. Hell, we couldn't spray the pile of rice, you know, we've got to go to Washington and all that kind of jazz. And of course, interesting, you know, the story on the rice was the spray didn't really hurt, it just changed color, and then the religion
black.
It from
eating. Black, yeah. Yeah, they could have eaten it. They didn't know what they were doing.
But
we had a place called the Rice Bowl that we used to go and hit every 4 months, it seems like. And it was a rotten way. It was a rotten target, because there was only one way to go, and they always knew when we were coming. So we decided that we weren't going to tell them this year when we were going, and we got it cleared that we had a sphere of targets that covered the whole northern half of northern South Vietnam. And that's how we got around the fragging thing. It wasn't that we went to a place we couldn't go to, but we were able to get a broader spectrum of targets that were called tertiary. And that was the secret to our success up there, was going to tertiary targets rather than primaries. Every time we went to a primary target, we got the daylights blasted at us. There's no question in my mind that there was a breakdown somewhere, that the intelligence on our activities was well known to VC in the early days. Now, I'm sure I'm sure that all changed later. Remember, we're talking to her, we're dealing with a province chief, we'd call him up and tell him something, and he didn't like the other province, you know, I don't want to talk about that. No, turn that off. I got to tell you about two guys that flew together and managed to get shot three times flying together.
Then you're off the red train.
They started out, they got hit in the windscreen just like everybody else does, and got a bunch of face puffed up and the arms would blowed up and all that. And of course that was right after I'd taken over the flight, and it was my first group of folks that had been hurt. So as soon as we landed, we of course immediately had a big party, and I gave them 5 days off to go to Kachikawa and get healed up and have a good time. They deserved it. They had just been shot. Well, away they went. They were back in about 3 days. And I thought, boy, that's dedication. So I didn't think too much more about that.
I'm going to get a beer. Then, does anybody want anything?
No.
No.
So then the second time they got hit, they were 35,000 feet. They took a hit from a 50 cal in one of the rubber plantations, which was off limits for airstrikes, so it was a free zone for the VC to set up their guns in. And it was one in a million shots. You can't hardly get a 50 cal to fire up to 35,000 feet, and then how do you hit a windscreen, you know, it's just one in a million as far as we're concerned. The Golden BB is what we call it, I guess. And this gave Clyde and Beakley another face full of glass. So this time I said, okay, guys, gee, you're all shot up. You're clear to go to taxi for 5 days. And both of them declined it. And I didn't understand what their approach to this was. I thought, nobody's that heroic. Everybody needs a few days in Tachi County. So they hung around for 5 days, and they got all healed up. I said, now we want to go to Tachi County. And I said, well, Weenies, what are you doing to me? They said, well, hell, last time we went up there, we was all shot up and looking ugly. They said, hell, yeah, we couldn't get a drink at the bar. Everybody's asking about your hero stuff and all that. They said, we want to go up there and drink and have a good time, look like normal people. So they took their 5 days after they healed up. The third time they got shot, John Beakley had decided that he was behind me in missions. Well, I made sure everybody was behind me in missions because I was the leader, and I ran a Democratic outfit. After I picked out where I was sitting in the flight, then the rest of them could have a seat, a chair, as we called it. And John convinced me one night by bribing me with a bottle of EO and a lot of whining and crying. Of course, you got a picture of John, 6'2" or something, a big Texan. His idea of whining was to twist my arm, squeeze my neck a few times. Anyway, I decided I'd let John take my seat. And sure enough, first pass, they took a 30 cal right through the windscreen, went through John's plastic protective eye visor. The bullet lodged in the skin of his head. And there was a navigator, it was a lead aircraft. John was in the left seat, Clyde Peach in the right, and Animal was the navigator. Well, John makes this great statement to Clyde. Clyde, I've been shot. And Clyde says, John, I get shot every time I fly with you. What the hell is new? Pull the nose up, we're going in the trees. And John said one more time, Clyde, damn it, I told you I've been shot. And he reached up under his helmet and pulled the bullet out and showed it to Clyde, and it passed out over the wheel. This pushed the airplane down in the trees a little more, and Clyde's yanking on the wheel, and Animal's yanking on John and the wheel, and they get it going back up out of the trees. Pull John out of the seat, lay him down in the back of the airplane. Flight mech starts working on him. Animal, in the meantime, gets to the left seat. They come back in, they land at Da Nang, and the Marine, we've been screaming bloody murder on every channel we've got in the airplane looking for help, because we know we got a guy that's hurt. And the Marines pick him up in a chopper and lift him off to their medevac station right there near the field. Now Clyde and the navigator chuggy down the runway. In the meantime, F-4s are going around because there's a 123 chugging down the runway. Turn off, park the airplane. Meantime, they got me through the command post, and I'm running down there because I know I got somebody hurt bad. And as I come up, I hit a slick, the plane is just bubbling oil all over the ramp, and I'm on a Honda, and I hit a slick of oil, and I went right on my butt and slid right into the wing commander's staff car as he's getting out, and that didn't please him too much. And this is again Colonel Stanfield. So he gets up in the cockpit, and he is totally irate. He says, you knucklehead stomping on a runway, what kind of pilots are you? I've got fighters out there trying to land. And he's ranting and raving. He gets up in the cockpit and looks over in the left seat, and he says, are you the pilot? Old Animal says, oh, I'm a goddamn navigator. This shakes him up a little bit. He says to Clyde, he says, are you the pilot? Clyde doesn't say much. He's a New Englander. He says, nope. But Clyde reaches down, grabs Beakley's helmet, and holds it up with the bullet hole, which looked like it was dead center right through between the eyes, but it wasn't, as we know. And he holds that up, and he says, that's the pilot. Colonel gets off the airplane, looks at all the holes in it. We got the best support the ranch ever got after that. We got a Jeep. We got things we never had. We got maintenance. We got places to live. They took us out of the tents. It was a whole new world. So The next time that Clyde gets hit, I think Clyde got hit a total of 5 times. And he never got an easy one, it didn't seem like. But he took a same old game. He was flying over a quote, protected rubber tree plantation. And sure enough, another golden BB came up through the floor, 50 cal, steel jacket, peeled off everything except the steel core of that thing, and it hit him in the back of the ankle, and the bullet followed the bone in his leg right up to the knee. And he had a different co-pilot with him, though. Beakley wasn't with him on this. When the bullet came through, it knocked out about a little over half, about a silver dollar-sized hunk of steel plating. And you know how thick that is. That must be half-inch steel plate. It lodged in the front, in the chest of the co-pilot's flak jacket, and was just sitting there, sticking out. The co-pilot fainted, and Clyde continued to fly the airplane. So Clyde tells us, I've been hit, I'm hurt bad, but I think my co-pilot's dead. He's got a big piece of metal sticking out of his chest. Now, based on that information, I'm screaming for any kind of help in the world and any place to put him down. And again, the nearest place is Da Nang. So we get into Da Nang, and I figured we had enough ambulances waiting for us there to outfit a small nation, because everybody knew we were in trouble. We'd let the whole world down. But there was nothing anybody could do for us until those guys got the airplane on the ground. The next voice we heard was the co-pilot. He says, Clyde's passed out, but I think I'm all right. I'm going to try and land it. Airplane starts down final. Just on final, we hear this voice that says, my co-pilot's passed out. This is Clyde. I'll make the landing. So they made a landing that was reasonable. It wasn't bad at all. They actually turned the airplane off at the first intersection, and then the whole world converged on them. Well, I was right behind them. I landed as soon as they were cleared the runway, pulled off in the grass, ran over, let my co-pilot take the airplane back to the ramp. And here they are. They've got the co-pilot. He's laid out on a stretcher. Everybody's looking at him, and there's a piece of jagged metal sticking out of his black vest. They're all concerned, and I look at Clyde, and I said, I thought you said you were hurt. He says, yeah, I took a 50 in my left leg. With that, I grabbed the medics. The co-pilot didn't have a mark on it. It was Clyde that was hurt. He was really shot. The guy in the right seat, the damn thing had just embedded in his black jacket. He kept falling out. He kept fainting because he kept looking down at it. He thought it was stuck in his chest.
A piece of metal that big was about the equivalent of getting hit with a baseball bat square in the chest.
You know what I'm saying? But he kept passing out. Clyde was the one that really, we sent Clyde home after that. He went home, and I hope someday his kids will realize he was quite a guy. The stories he tells them isn't any BS. He got hit a lot of times.
You mentioned the protected plantations. What do you mean by that?
Well, we weren't allowed to spray. God knows how close to it. They were so goosey about them. I think it cost us $80 a tree, and a drop of defoliant was supposed to be lethal to one tree. So that was a real no-no.
You're talking about you're not allowed to spray the rubber plantations.
Even near them. Even if there was even a. There was even a potential of drift, and of course we all know that the stuff can drift. But
was this the directive from the Vietnamese or from the U.S.?
No, the Vietnamese I don't think cared. I think it was the State Department was more concerned about that than anybody else.
Well, it wound its way into a policy. I don't know where it originally.
Yeah, I guess we did a lot of harm to a few of that before we knew how really susceptible they were to herbicides. Yeah.
Maybe weren't the best, but they were determined to come out of there with medals and honors and all that kind of stuff, and they could dictate that in a smaller group.
Well, do you think the flying was hairier up out of Da Nang?
No.
High core flying?
No.
You don't think mountains were tougher than flatlands?
No, not at all.
Oh, it was tougher. Hot flying for traces. Of course it was. Anybody could fly across a flat piece of landscape.
There's much more shooting in the south.
Oh, I ain't talking. You said flying. I'm saying the flying. The difficulty level of flying, the mission was harder up there. Well, I'm not going to. I wouldn't compete with you on ground fire. Hell no. Flatlands, they can see you coming and going. They're shooting at you all the way. No. The difficulty
actually,
maneuvering
the
aircraft.
Some of the toughest flying was inland there from the Trang and Phan Rang. Some of those goddamn hills we did in there.
Oh, yeah.
Some of those were the
one-way Hummers.
Up toward Dalat and that area.
That may have been as far as putting everything together, ground fire and airplane yeah, control right. may have just been the toughest.
They were more populated, the more people, the more bullets. And, of course, agreed. I wouldn't argue with anybody. I'd rather fly over a 300-foot canopy any day because they can't see you. They can't really do any harm.
Well, to you. And up north, you didn't have much of this shit, you know, because you could chart it better.
Yeah.
But down there, man, you just had to have a couple
that's
of those
right.
hummers, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
Then you come over the damn thing and you got the molasses on the window, especially if you're...
Yeah.
And that you can see those twirls, you know, coming off the spray, you know,
vortex,
how the
yeah.
air comes off the top. And if you were less than proficient, and sometimes even then, you just couldn't stay out of the spray.
Well, especially on a crop target where you were zigging in and out, on trying to jump it back and forth from field to field, you pretty well got to follow a lead, et cetera, and yell, I got crop to the right. Well, whoever's on his right's got to take it. And you couldn't help but go through his spray. And it's spray on, spray off. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, no problem.
That was
the
probably the most unfun of the whole thing.
The mountains were where it took two people. Yeah, you had to think as a pair of Siamese twins. In the flatlands, with everything set up, not too shabby, except the ground fire was horrendous. In the mountains, the ground fire was greatly reduced, but the flying skill, I thought, was a little more required. I didn't want a weak sister with me up there. I want somebody who knew when to smash the throttle up, and if I didn't tell him to, he was going to smash it up and chop some flaps sometimes to get up the crest of the hill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I've
slipped down 5-10 degrees in a hurry several times.
You know what I mean. I was talking about skill.
Well, I tell you one thing I did a lot of north, which really wasn't procedurally correct, but I give a shit how good you are. That airspeed doesn't stay nailed all the time.
Yeah. No, hold on.
And you get that third guy back there, and you're doing this kind of stuff. Rather, I just tell him right in the briefing, my base speed's 135. I'll check it up a little bit. And that makes a big difference. Just says five knots.
You say that number three man. We lost the number three man. I forget who it was. It happened during the time you were there.
If that three guy screws up and closes up a little bit at the wrong time,
he couldn't crest the hill. Number three couldn't crest him and lead it and slow them up.
So rather than fly, when you fly lead, you really fly three airplanes or four airplanes or five airplanes, whatever you got. And I think sometimes it's best to fly it from the back forward and determine what you're going to do.
I've been left hanging and stuttering.
You let the guy, he's just trying to peel off a couple knots, and then all once this comes, and, you know, there's maybe some chatter or something that gets you diverted, and I don't care how good you are, you're not perfect.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. That's why I say that. The mountains is where the two-pilot concept was critical.
Now, did you have K models when you were there? Okay, how much difference did the K model make having the jets out there?
Well, of course, I think probably the biggest thing on the K was it was mental, you know. You had the 2 inches of idle.
Confidence factor,
we always had the... But of course, the scary thing about the K is you had two little toggle switches about maybe an inch long, and they were electrically enunciated. And, you know, you're used to your whole life flying a throttle and playing with it, and here's this little switch. And quite often there wasn't much correlation between the left switch and the right switch. You know, one might be at 80%, the other at 60%. So you had to be a little ginger with the darn things. Of course, when you're flying, you've got some speed, normally the rudder control, but it could get anxious, really, if you feathered a prop and brought your jets in and they were come up the wrong way. So, you know, the importance of the other pilot is you got to watch that damn RPM.
You know? Do you have them at idle on target normally?
Then we come off the target with them. You know, spray off, everybody reports in, build up the speed, jets are in, and then...
I bet that bounced you up in a hurry. That would have been sweet.
I'd like that. Oh, yeah, you could, take them up Cowboys, and you're going through 5,000 feet. And shut them down.
We never saw them.
I don't think we ever got to 5,000 feet most of the time.
We had a plane.
The fuel usage on the jet, when you're running, one jet uses as much fuel as both pop.
Is that right? We had an emergency plan in Ashaw, which was a bad target for us initially, but I don't know whether it was overrated or not. We took an awful lot of hits there, and we did get the daylight shot out of us in Ashaw. I never considered it personally as any different a target than any other. I think it was more of it's one of those that's like the Marne.
Now, Ashaw had the bad rep.
Well, we did have a plan, and it consisted of...
I've been up down as much as anybody, and I never hear a bullet.
Yeah, and without it, if we lost an engine, fully loaded, we would dump, but if we lost an engine, there was a particular area in there we couldn't get out. And we had a contingency, you know, the three fields that we're in are all mine, so you couldn't land on the fields. We would orbit as long as possible and put it in the sawgrass, or in the elephant grass, I mean. That was worst case. You know, you had to have a lot of things go wrong to be at that point. But that was the only place where we had that type of an emergency.
I had more bullets come out of elephant grass than I did trees, I'll
yeah,
tell you that.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I want to tell you one about the crew at the end of the valley. We got one of those superior briefings from our intelligence people that said, there are no VC over there. We just had patrols go through the, you know, at the top of the valley, north end of the valley.
Were there two little landing strips there?
Well, yeah, but then at the north end, there's three valleys that go out, little ones, offshoots.
Fingers,
yeah. So we were supposed to do the first finger. We had a flight of three B-57s with us, and they were armed to the teeth. I love that 57, because they're 20 mic, 50 cal, and 16 500 pounders, and I don't know what they can hang
on. Now, were these the U.S. or the Aussie 57s?
No, these were ours.
Okay.
And we went down the first valley, and we must
have... Yeah, bring me one, two birds.
We must have caught the worst group of VC there ever was. They were all E-9 gunners, and they just did a number on us. I took a shot through my left engine that opened the engine up just like this, and there was all kinds of wires and things hanging at it, and of course, I never looked at gauges. I'm flying. Eichelman was a right seater. We're down in it. There's no place to go. It's downhill all the way until you come out into Eshaw. You know, I didn't have any choice on that, so I just continued on downhill. And nothing changed, not a sound. But I could look at that hole, and it was about a foot and a half, almost 2 feet across. Blown back like that, pieces of cables and things hanging out of it. Horrible looking thing, not a change in the engine sound. So we got down to the bottom, and I said, we ain't going back in there again. I said, what's the engines look like? He says, everything's perfect. And they were running fine. So we said, okay, let's try the second valley. They must be the second valley is the one that's really quiet, right? So we, left out one thing. One of the hits took, you know, the overhead antenna, the HF? Took it off right behind the cockpit of number two airplane. And it went, of course, it immediately trailed back. We went back to
taste testers.
Not me.
I'm Pete, but I appreciate it. We'll punch that up and I'll finish this thing up for you.
Okay, go ahead.
It's on?
Yeah. Okay. By the way, how many have you got? Did you say you're number two? How many planes do you have?
Well, we only have three. See, okay. Our days we never flew more than three. All right. He shoots off the antenna. It's trailing behind him. We go up to the second valley and we start in. And it's just like the first valley, only worse, because they're awake, and now they really got some time to, you know, get ready and put more clips around, and they really are shooting the daylights out of us. So we said, okay,
ready?
Bad, really gross. We're going to the third valley, and if we get one shot, we're going home. We started down the third valley, and as we turned into it, I looked back, and we're flying, boy, we were flying tight. We were hanging in for one another, because we didn't know what the hell was going to happen next. Here's the wire, here's the antenna wire. You remember that? The antenna wire that was traveling from the two, and it looked like it was towing three. And we always felt that the VC was calling back to Hanoi and saying, boy, what tough guys these ranch hands are. You shoot them up and they tow them back over to Turkey. Looked just like it was being towed. Yeah. Remember that? Didn't we get that daylight shot out of us?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you were up there with me looking at that 20
inch. I thought they
were
the
four shooters. They're just a three shooter.
I never had one. Well, what happened was we brought one down from Da Nang and three.
You already had four airplanes, didn't you?
From Saigon. We met up there. Remember? Is that how we did it? Yeah, we met on the other side over by.
There might have been another one. I don't know.
Anything over six was just a show off day anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to say I never flew. I flew maybe one or two in four, yeah. But mostly there were three. The only thing I was laughing about was that they had tennis string in the back. It looked just like he was throwing at them. Oh, well, whatever. Okay, we're up at Da Nang. I don't know any of the machinations of the move as far as what all that was about. Art, or these guys can tell you that. But Kubli knew everybody in the world, and somewhere he'd gotten about 400 smoke grenades of every color you can think of. And he wired three of my airplanes all over with about 500 strings coming in with pull rings on them. And we took off from Saigon, Thon Son Nhut, circled out, and he had it all laid up with the tower, and he went down the main street with all this smoke pouring off the back end. And I mean, he went down below the houses in the street. And I had to pick up a wing to get over a, to get over some cars. And then he went to Benoit at about 5 feet altitude. And he had the same deal laid up with them. And he went right up the main street of Benoit with all his smoke going. He went up and did a 360 overhead, and we landed. We got to the club. No wing commander came, nobody came, not one soul said a word. I know not how he got away with it. I'll tell you, it was the hairiest I've ever seen a buzz job pulled in my life. He put that thing in the grass. He had them props throwing dirt up off the streets. I never saw anything. I must have driven anybody on the ground right out of their mind. But what a beautiful sight. What a beautiful sight. Fighter pilots loved it. They loved it. They thought that was the greatest thing in the world.
Well, who was it?